Good morning. This is News Talk Breakfast with Shane Coleman and Jonathan Healy. It's Wednesday, the 28th of February.
On the show this morning, calls for an end to lifelong driving licences, plans to make politicians' home addresses private, and is it time to consider shortening the school summer holidays?
I think if we were in line with primary school, we'd still have a lovely long holiday and the opportunity to have all those lovely experiences over summer.
Also coming up, revitalising our town centres, universities sound a warning on Leaving Cert reform, and Media Minister Catherine Martin faces 3 hours of questioning at the media committee last night.
She was indicating she might resign if I sent a letter, but I was just hopeful that she'd reflect and think about having a meeting with me.
In sport, the Irish women lose 2-0 to Wales in an international friendly, while Haaland hits 5 as Man City batter Luton.
All that and more on the way, but first let's go to the newsroom and say good morning to Shane Beattie.
On 106 to 108 FM, on the News Talk app, powered by Go Loud and Smart Speaker, this is News Talk.
In summary then, did Catherine Martin vindicate herself? I mean, she's not going to be fired by Leah Varadkar because it's a collective anyway, and they don't want to lose a government minister in within the 12 months of an election, that's for sure. So did she do herself a favour or did she do herself more harm?
I think there was probably a consensus that the minister shouldn't have done the primetime programme anyway. And Aisling is correct. I mean, interviews get, and as I'm sure your programme knows as well, interviews can get pulled all the time for various reasons. That said, what very clearly emerged, because it was, you know, a question from my colleague Chris O'Sullivan, which revealed the details of this letter and the threat to resign, and then we probed it further. And in those circumstances, once you have that breakdown in trust, there's only one option. So I think we did get a bit better understanding of where the minister was coming from on this. The concern, I think there is a general concern, however, that this crisis at RTE is continuing. I think most people were hoping, you know, we were finally beginning to see the end of this. I was glad that the minister did indicate that, you know, she was broadly happy with the general direction of travel and reforms that Kevin Backhurst are implementing. And I'm not saying Kevin Backhurst hasn't made a number of missteps, but, you know, he's inheriting a very difficult organisation. He is trying to carry out the necessary reforms. And at the end of this, and I know we've talked about this before, it is essential that we have quality public service broadcasting in Ireland, provided as much by news.
Did you not say that you did not have confidence in Kevin Backhurst?
And no, I said I did have confidence in Kevin Backhurst. A number of my colleagues indicated that they didn't, on the basis that Kevin Backhurst would have been at meetings and, in a sense, didn't correct Shuni Rahalig, where, you know, there was what seemed to be that miscommunication.
Yeah. But would you, at a meeting with Micheál Martin, and he makes an error, would you say, by the way, Taoiseach, you got that one wrong? In front of, and embarrass him in front of people. I don't think you would, Malcolm. Yeah. With all due respect to your confidence.
It is important to remember that, you know, what happened was on the Thursday morning, Shuni Rahalig did contact department officials to clarify the issue.
It's an utterly miserable existence, but yet this compulsion. I mean, we're always hoping for the big win. Was that the dream?
Yeah, that was the dream. But after a while, the realization comes to you that that's not going to happen. But it still doesn't stop you, and it's been proven as well that compulsive gamblers, I use that term and not problem. It's just old school thing. But you get as much of a hit or a buzz from the loss than you do the win, and chasing the losses can become an infatuation too. And the way I handled it was just to lock myself away at home. Like when I got locked up in October 2020, I was 29 and a half stone going into prison. I was morbidly obese, and that was purely down to my behaviours and binge eating out of depression. So the knock-on effect of that was horrific.
What sort of extremes did you go to get money? Who did you con? Who did you steal from?
I stole from electronics companies that I would have given cock and bull stories to get mobile phones that I knew I could sell to the cheap mobile phone shops. I came up with scams to sell, pretended that I had match tickets for Rugby World Cups and things like that, and I got money from rugby clubs that I wasn't able to get them the tickets for. And then there was a whole host of smaller scams over the years where I would have just told lies to people about cars being broken into or whatever, and they'd lend you money. And, you know, again, all justified to me by the fact that I was genuinely thinking I'd be able to pay them back, and I couldn't. And I did it, a lot of it, and I have to be honest about this, I did a lot of it without remorse at the time, you know. And it was only when I went into prison and I worked with a particular counsellor in prison that I learned about my behaviour, about where it came from with the childhood issues, and where it came from with the effects that I was having on people that I stole from, and the effects that I was having on people like my family and my friends. These were things that I never saw before. And when I sat down to write this book, and when I was working with the counsellor, and she made me look at these things, that didn't sit well with me. Yeah.
You had been so self-centred that you didn't see other people's pain.
No, not at all. You can just see your own and your own aspirations, and you justify things to yourself to get by.
What were the particular charges that resulted you with the prison sentence?
The prison sentence I got was for rugby match tickets, one of the rugby club scams. And then while I was in prison, I was charged with the electronics thing where I got the phones. And there was a couple of those charges there. So those were what I was ultimately sentenced.
But there could have been many more if people had pursued you.
If I hadn't repaid them, yeah. And, you know, yeah.
Now, in prison, you know, you grow up in a respectable family, no expectation that one of the family members will end up in the slammer.
No.
What was that like, just for you, first of all, and then for those around you and close to you?
For those around me and close to me, I'm sure it was hell, you know. I mean, there was the embarrassment, there was worry for me. My friends would have to constantly justify me to people that they met who'd have a go at me, why, you know, and they stood by me for, geez, over 35 years. I don't know why to this day, but they still do. From my own perspective, it was a massive sense of relief when I finally did go to prison, because I knew it was an inevitability. It was something that was there for me.
It was hanging over you all the time.
All those years. And I knew that I knew that someday I was going to end up there.
And what was the prison life like? Now, I'm not thinking that your life outside prison was that great, locked in a room surrounded by laptops and electronics and binge eating, not a very attractive lifestyle. But still, to lose your liberty is a big deal.
It is, and it came at a particularly bad time insofar as we were right in the middle of COVID, and prison, like everywhere, didn't quite know how to deal with the COVID outbreak. So we spent a lot of time in 24/7 quarantine. Like, I would have spent large chunks of time in a cell by myself with no contact with anybody. But I can't complain, because without being dramatic, prison saved my life, you know, in so many ways, because I developed an attitude in prison where I was going to finally try and do something about myself. I did something about my weight. I got a college degree. I got a university degree while I was in there. Those are two things that I would never, ever have done. And I have no doubt today, and I can say this hand on heart, that I'd be dead now, because the way I was eating, I was candidate for a heart attack. And the morning I walked to prison, or to court to go to prison, I just looked in over the bridge and the river looked appealing to me. And that's the way my life was heading.
I suppose it's like everything, you know, you don't even realise it exists until you immerse yourself into it, and then suddenly...
I've never heard of world schooling before till today.
Neither had we until we went to the Dominican Republic. We didn't know anything about it. When we left for the 6 months, actually, all we had booked was one-way flights to Dominican Republic, and we booked the kids into a school called The Hive in the Dominican Republic for 6 weeks. And the hive was probably was full of, I don't know, maybe 20, between 20 and 30, you know, international families from all over the world. And they did it in 6 week blocks. So once we got in and we got kind of immersed into that community, it just opened up a whole new world of, you know, families that were, some of them like us, just popping in and then gone again. And then others who are doing it full time. And you know, that was October 21. And a lot of them are still on the road in Vietnam and Bali and, you know, South Africa, who just like to travel. They work online. And they go around and they either do it solo or else they immerse themselves in these pop-up schools along the way. And it's a whole, I mean, it's very common when you're kind of in that setting, you know.
What age were the kids, Danny, at the time, sorry, your own children?
I think when we left, they were, for October 21, something like 8, 10 and 12.
Okay, 8, 10 and 12. So they're, you know, at that stage, they have a good few years, 18, you know, completed in primary school here at home in Ireland. Like, how did they manage, I suppose, with the education system, what they were learning? Like, how did that work out for them when you were away?
So obviously, when we were away, we did our best to keep up with the schoolwork. But I mean, we didn't spend all day, every day at it. And I suppose the reading and the maths, you know, they're the two big things for us. So if you know, the 6 months, if they got a bit of that every day, and believe me, some days we didn't do it at all. But I just felt they were learning so much in general. You know, they're learning so much about other cultures, other and the people, how to mix socially with kids of different languages who come from different backgrounds. That was enough for us. I mean, I'm actually a primary teacher myself, and I could see the benefit in everything else that they can do outside of the school setting. Yeah. I mean, in my eyes, the classroom is, you know, no classroom should have walls. I mean, so much more can be learnt in the outdoors. And there is a place for, you know, maths and English and Irish, you know, all of those basics also. But they fell back into regular school. I mean, they're all in regular school now. They're in.
Did they? And they're not.
Fourth class. Sorry,
kind of where they were, basically, Aideen, are they?
Yeah, they are. Yeah. Of course they are. Yeah, they're fine. I mean, of course, when they came back, I remember Amelia, the little one, when she came back, she said, everyone in my class is doing cursive writing. And you know, they had learned how to cursive write when she left. And she said, it's just funny writing. I don't know, Mum, what language it is. So she had missed out on that. But sure, she picked up after a few weeks. You know, she was behind a bit. But I mean, in my heart, if she never learned to cursive write, it wasn't going to be the end of her education.
I know.
She was learning so much more. Yeah.
I suppose it's the value, Danny, that you put on life experience as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like, I suppose, look, we all get caught up in it. And, you know, and it's where we are at the moment, whereby each week is a kind of a copy and paste of the previous week. And you kind of, you know, you throw yourself into Monday and you're thrown out again Sunday evening and it's back in again. And weeks repeat themselves. And suddenly, you know, it's March already, when Christmas only seems like, you know, a week or two ago. Mm. And the year just goes past like that. So it's kind of when you stop and you step out of it and, you know, you remove, you know, a lot of the noise and distractions that occupy us, that, you know, the whole world opens up. And it's a really amazing experience to, I suppose, to spend time with your kids when you don't have those weekly and daily distractions and stress and you know, people grabbing your attention. It's an incredible experience to spend a prolonged period of time kind of on the same wavelength as your kids. And you just get to know it. I know it sounds a bit odd when you're living with them for 10 years, but you really get to know them so much better and their personalities. You know, we came back from those trips, you know, a much stronger unit.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Do you find yourself wrestling with a rebellious router? Or maybe your smartphone is acting smarter than you? Whatever your tech troubles, I'm here to help unravel your mysteries. The Tech Talk mailbag is your chance to get involved. Got a gadget that has you stumped? An app more perplexing than practical? I want to hear about it. Just tap out your message and send it over to techtalk@newstalk.com. It is that simple. Remember, no question is too big or too small, too techie or too trivial.
Tech Talk.
In association with Viatel Technology Group.
Listen and subscribe to the podcast now or tune in Saturday at 5.
News Talk. Conversation that counts.
announced in the last few minutes today, John O'Shea has been appointed interim Republic of Ireland manager, and our own Stephen Doyle from Off the Ball is here with me today. Is it a surprise announcement, Stephen?
Well, Andrea, I don't think it's a surprise that he's getting the job on an interim basis. The FAI are saying that he's going to be in charge for the friendly matches next month against Belgium and Switzerland. The reason he is because they haven't been able to appoint a permanent successor to Stephen Kenny. That search will hit 100 days this Saturday, and it's nearly as long as the search for Giovanni Trapattoni took, which was 112 days. So they will surpass that, because they've said in the statement today that they are close to appointing a permanent successor, and they will announce that in early April. So to me, that sounds like they're just buying time because...
But is this a try? Like, is it likely to be John O'Shea?
It could be. Listen, the thing about John O'Shea is he has no experience as a first-team senior manager. He's had a couple of coaching jobs since he retired from playing. He coached with Reading over in the English Championship. He was assistant coach for the Republic of Ireland under-21s with Stephen Kenny for 3 years almost. He then worked at Stoke City before coming back to the Irish senior setup, working under Stephen Kenny. And then he had an unsuccessful spell with Wayne Rooney, who was the manager at Birmingham City. But the one thing he would have learned from all those different jobs is, well, he would have gained a lot of experience and see how different managers do their job. I think he is a very well-respected, look at it this way, if you go into a dressing room with Republic of Ireland senior players, he will instantly command respect from those players because of what he's achieved himself. He was capped 118 times. He's in that rare club, or small club of players who won over 100 caps playing for Ireland over 17 years. He's played at 2 European Championship finals for Ireland as well. So he's a lot of experience. And as well as that, playing for Manchester United, he made over 250 appearances for them. He won 5 Premier League titles, a Champions League and an FA Cup. So he is a man who knows how to win things.
Has he the support of the fans?
Listen, the one thing I'll say about John O'Shea is he's not just popular with his teammates, he's also very popular with Irish supporters as well.
Okay.
He's a very affable guy. I spoke to him a lot over the years as a player, interviewing him after matches. One thing that always struck me about John O'Shea, Andrea, is that speaking to him after games, post-match interviews are the worst interviews you can do as a sports journalist, because it's very hard to get, you know, obviously the athletes, they're pumping with adrenaline. It's very hard for them to assess a match when they've just come off the pitch and all that kind of thing. John O'Shea was always very calm, relaxed. He could always give a very good, calm breakdown of a match. And I think that's really crucial if you're going to be a manager. You have to be a good communicator. And I think that's important, not just with the players he's going to be working with, but also with the fans. When he speaks to the media, I think he's going to be able to handle that really well.
Our son has decided he's a vegan. A number of his classmates have done the same. They love watching nature documentaries together, which we encourage. But now we're dealing with a child who refuses to eat the dinner that's put in front of him. He's 14. Is that the age where he insists on scowling at the rest of us as we eat bolognese or chicken drumsticks, which has put a bad feeling on the family kitchen table? I keep telling myself it's a phase, but it's been going on for 2 weeks now, and I'm exhausted cooking 2 different meals every night. I'm also worried that he may not be getting the nutrients that he would be getting as part of his diet if he was eating meat. I told him a few times that I've no problem if he wants to do this when he's a bit older and we can do some research into a balanced vegan diet, but he refuses. My head is melted as I'm worrying that way, the way he is currently eating is unhealthy.
Oh, 2 weeks in. It's a big change. Look, he has made this choice, so he must also be part of the solution to it and the way of dealing with it. Because I'm hearing in this a frazzled parent cooking 2 dinners, some of which is picked at by the vegan who wants to be vegan but isn't actually eating a healthy, good vegan diet, because a good vegan diet will give him all the nutrients he needs, just to be clear about that. So it's sounding like a pasta vegan diet going on, and that's not sustainable. I totally agree with you. You might have to find a good vegan cookbook. There are, thankfully, so many of those out there now. I stopped eating meat when I was much younger, and really your options were penne pasta with tomato sauce. Where you went, like, things have changed so much. So you could also have him flick through that book, select 2 meals. You could get the ingredients and help him, but he has to be there. He's doing more than you're doing. You're just supporting. Batch cooking Saturday or Sunday, he batch cooks like a big vegan bolognese or a shepherdless pie or whatever it might be. And that's portioned out and that is his meal. He can do 2, 3, 4 batch cooks if he wants, but 2 is probably achievable. But he has to be a part of that, because you can say, I support you in this and I'm going to show you that one night of the week, I will be cooking a meat-free dinner for all of us. The other nights of the week, you're going to batch cook at the weekend to make sure you have what you need. So the because I can cook one meal, I do not have time to cook two meals during the week. And I think if you approach it in a calm way, that and if he's like, no, I'm not cooking.
Well, then,
there's, and if you're concerned about him or you think he's not taking it seriously enough, you could say, look, we're going to have to go to the doctor, make sure you're healthy and well, because you're really not eating well for the last month, 2 months. And there are ways of doing this. There is a way to support him with his veganism. And it seems to have come from a motivation through documentaries and social action. And all of that is really good. And he's at the age for that. But I think he needs to be an active participant in the lifestyle change, rather than giving you an extra job for him.
Yeah.
Like, it was expected, because of the nature of the accusation and the court he was in, that he would be released on bail, but the judge denied him bail and has detained him for another 2 days for a hearing tomorrow. So, so that's where he is at the moment.
Have you been able to speak to him?
No, I haven't spoken to him yet. I haven't talked to him since Sunday night. He was out for dinner and he's saying, I'll see you. I'm going to the airport early in the morning, and we were going to skip ballet and go and collect from the airport. Yeah. So I haven't spoken to him since then, no.
And has he received any consular assistance from any embassies in Iraq?
So I have we have a consulate in, we don't have one in Baghdad. We have one in Amman, and I've been in touch with them, and I know Artanishta as well has been in touch with me, and they are doing everything they can. And I'm really grateful and appreciative of all of the efforts they are putting in. I suppose as the time goes on, it's getting more and more stressful and more urgent that more pressure is put, as much pressure as possible is put on the Iraqi authorities to release him.
Did he, and I know this kind of may sound like a strange question to people listening at home, some people, Laura, but did he enter Baghdad, did he enter Iraq on his Irish passport?
Yeah, he only has an Irish passport.
Okay,
so he's not an Iraqi citizen.
He's not a citizen of any other country. Because the reason I ask is just because people, I think, listening to you are going to immediately be thinking about someone like Ibrahim Halawa a few years ago. And one of the complications there for Ibrahim was that he had used his Egyptian passport to go into the country, which kind of tied the hands of Ireland to a degree diplomatically. There was kind of only limited support they could offer. But that's not the situation here.
No. No Iraqi documentation whatsoever. He went in with it, and he went in with his Irish passport as an Irishman to visit his family. And the information I've received is that was taken from him. The passport has been taken from him. And
And Laura, I mean, your sense of this, and I'm kind of just trying to read between the lines here, is that he's been locked up because he highlights corruption within the country. Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, as I said to you, like, my information is the information I'm getting is from on the ground from his brother. I don't have concrete information, you know, the way from a department or from the government or, you know, so I'm just going on what I have. And yes, I do get the sense that that's the reason. It's a ludicrous. I do get the reason that that's why he's been detained. Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine how difficult it is for ye as well, several days into it. What did you say, Sunday evening? Was that the last time you spoke to him?
Yeah, it's his kids. Yeah, I mean, we're wearing now. Yeah, his kids are missing him. And obviously, like, I have such incredible support around me, and I'm so, so grateful for that. Like, I listen to you all the time, and I hear people who are going through stressed situations, and they talk about an outpouring support. My God, I had no idea that this is what it is. And I'm so grateful for that. My family, my friends, and just literally every single person who knows him in the world. So that's helping. But obviously the kids are like, what is going on? And their routine is kind of scuppered a bit.
I think, are they 5, 4 and 2? I mean, the older, the five, does the five-year-old know what's happened?
Yeah, and I have actually, so I'm a principal of a school in Colester, so I would have worked with like critical incidents before, and I would kind of understand there's an importance in being truthful to a certain point where you're not like worrying them, but at the same time, not making up stuff. So I've talked to her, and she is aware that we're we're trying to get Daddy home. There are some issues. We don't know when he'll be home, but everybody's doing everything they can. And she's taken that on board. She had injections in school. I think that was a bigger issue today, to be honest. But but they're missing him. They're like, my brother is here, and loads of my friends, like it's like this majority females want Fernando, but my brother, they're asking him for hugs and stuff like that, and it's like they're missing him. They're missing him. They're wondering where he is. Yeah, and I'm missing him.
Yeah, I was going to say, how are you doing, Laura?
I'm kind of on a kind of an adrenaline kind of. I'm very focused. I'm being very well supported, so I'm trying to get the message out and create as much awareness as possible and do absolutely everything I can. So all of my energy, all of my capacity in myself is being directed towards that at the moment. But when tonight comes, it'll be a different story.